From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how a Milwaukee college is setting out to measure whether its graduates are truly ready for the work world.
Increasingly, even at small liberal arts colleges, faculty are really focused on helping students understand how what they learn in their major is multifaceted. It's partly content and it's partly capability.
Later, film critic Dave Lurson says the new film Lady Bird represents a triumph of coming-of-age films and for its director, Greta Gerwig.
I think that Lady Bird is a great step forward for her. This movie works very well as a compelling, genuine statement, I think, of herself, but I think it has universal meaning.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of Radio Chipstone and our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next after this news update.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Foxconn deal cleared two more hurdles this past week as boards in both Racine County and the Mount Pleasant Village approved agreements to build the factory campus on land in the community. The overall agreement is the biggest incentive package in history between the state and a private company. The company says the plant could eventually employ 13,000 people to build flat panel screens for electronic devices.
But whether that company is Foxconn or a much smaller employer, questions are always raised about whether people graduating from schools are ready for employment. Sometimes that question involves specialized skills, but increasingly, the questions are bigger and seemingly simpler. Are students prepared to join the workforce?
It is a field known as essential employability qualities, and a Milwaukee college will soon play a role in figuring out how they're measured. Carol Shabrias is Dean of the School of Adult Learning and New Initiatives at Alverno College, and she joined us in the studio to explain. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. I'm happy to be here.
So let's start with a working definition, if we can. What are we talking about when we talk about essential employable qualities?
We're really talking about a set of abilities that people have when they enter the world and engage with other people. So it's different from something like the ability to type or the ability to code. It's more about the ability to work in a space where there are other people who with you are thinking and leading and problem solving and disagreeing and challenging, and how you comport yourself in an environment like that.
But this goes over and above what we might think of simply as people skills, right? Or is this really what we're talking about?
You know, that's a good question. I feel like there's a way that this is getting at the heart of what it means to be human. Can you move in the world in a way that helps other people go with you and accomplish things with you? But when people talk about people skills and soft skills in terms of graduates from college, I think they're kind of missing depth. They're kind of thinking, you know, can you work on a team? Well, what the hell does that mean? Oh, I'm sorry, I just swore on radio.
That's all right.
All right. Yeah, so it's more than people skills. And Alverno's model is actually fundamentally about your personal understanding of yourself. And that's a version of people skill, but that has to do with self-awareness.
In some ways, it seems like a lot to add. I mean, and I realize there are a lot of older graduates at Alverno who might have a head start at mm-hmm. knowing themselves versus, you know, a 21 or 22-year-old who's coming out of college. But at some level, it seems like a lot to expect of a college graduate to be this complete formed person the second they walk out your door.
So we help them in sequential ways while they're with us. So this is not about the EEQ project, but Alverno's educational model requires students to practice and demonstrate competencies along the way, to get feedback from their faculty and to assess themselves on the same things that the faculty were assessing. And then the next time they're tested, as it were, they have to demonstrate self-awareness and growth. And so they may not be fully formed at 21 or 25 when they graduate, but they are practiced at growing and practiced at identifying the ways they need to continue their growth.
Well, and you said that's not specifically about the EEQs, but it's really related to it in a lot. I mean, it seems like that's why this is such a – being part of this pilot project is such a good match for Alverno, right?
Oh, absolutely. I should say more, but I don't know what
that's to say, all right. So. But okay, so let me ask then, and maybe you don't know the answer to this yet. How do you measure these kinds of things? I mean, this is not the same as can this person code at this level. This
right.
is not the same as has this person finished trigonometry or has this person been able to analyze existentialism. How do you tell whether a person leaving has the kinds of qualities that are going to be needed, maybe next week or maybe 5 years from now?
So let me talk about two pieces of that. One is about how you verify that a graduate has those skills, but the other is what it means to have a program that is also verified as producing those graduates. So Alverno is really practiced at producing those graduates. We have this sort of complicated matrix where we lay out the different competencies students have to achieve and give them multiple efforts at demonstrating that competency. And that's embedded throughout our curriculum. So we're really practiced at that piece. And it's one of the reasons that the QA Commons called us for the EEQ, because like other competency-based colleges, we're good at this. The EEQ piece is in development. So part of your question I can't answer yet.
Right.
So what they've said is we want a whole bunch of colleges who are good at this to help us build it so that they are informed by faculty members and administrators who are already engaged in best practices, because what they want at the end of the day is not something that works at Alverno or works somewhere else, but that works across a system so that there can be a national conversation about it and not only local conversations.
So you talk about the matrix and you talk about competencies. Can you give us a sense for what that looks like and feels like if you are a student at Alverno?
Sure. I'm looking right now at our outcomes for our business major. We have four competencies that all graduating students have to meet. One is in critical thinking, one is in leadership, one is in decision making, and then one is in something we call entrepreneurial careering, which is about a student's flexibility and adaptability as she plans her profession and engages in professional growth. So we can tell you, we've got this matrix that describes what each one of those are, maps it back to our abilities, and then has a whole set of learning activities that the faculty can use from and draw to both kind of build into their classrooms, but also to evaluate the students against. So the student can come in and see, these are the abilities, these are the outcomes, these are the kinds of ways I'm going to get validated, and I'll have a chance to practice and grow.
This has not always been the domain of higher education. I mean, I think, and probably to this day, there are still colleges and universities out there who say, look, it's our job to give them the book learning.
Yep.
And, whether they got the employability piece is not necessarily just on them, but, it's not our responsibility to make sure that student X is going to be the right worker for company Y.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, why has Alverno seen it differently through the years?
So, again, with the two-answer thing, we moved to this abilities model 40 years ago at a moment when we had a very progressive president who had a vision about what it would mean to put women in the workplace in a way that made them distinct. And that was kind of the heart and soul of our model. I think I would be in trouble with our faculty if I didn't also say the book learning matters, right? Yeah. The content really matters. And so we really embed both throughout every program. More and more, I mean, you know this, you hear this all the time, liberal arts doesn't matter, a college degree isn't worth it. Showing that, can I give an example?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
So I'm an English major. And so I learned—
An English major with a job.
An English major, right, right. I actually have 3 degrees in English and I still have a job. So I learned, I know, shocking, right?
You would think with each successive degree, you might be less employable.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. I know. So you learn when you study English a whole bunch of ways to analyze a whole bunch of texts. Well, there aren't that many jobs in the world where my ability to analyze poetry is going to get me hired. But what I learned as an English major was how to learn a framework and apply that framework in solving a problem. So I still learned all the literature. I learned novels and poetry and the whole range. But on the market, my job is to say, sure, I have that content piece, but I also have this ability to solve problems, to learn different ways of looking at the world, and that sort of thing.
Do you think you had professors who got that part, you know, who opened your eyes to that part of the equation?
No, and I would say
So you had to figure it out for yourself.
I'm old enough that I had to figure it out for myself, and I think this way now because of the kind of work I do. But increasingly, even at small liberal arts colleges, faculty are really focused on helping students understand how what they learn in their major is multifaceted. It's partly content and it's partly capability.
Well, and it seems like it takes a certain kind of faculty member to get both parts of the equation.
It really does. And it also takes an institution that has fundamentally its students' best interests at heart. And Alverno is distinct in a little bit in that I'll get in trouble with other schools if I say they're not. But we care so much about the region and we care so much about especially putting women to work in ways that stabilize their socioeconomic standing, that give them rewarding careers, that help their families. And you can't do all that if all you teach them is content. You have to teach them how to succeed with that material.
So, and again, maybe this is too early to say, but do you know how the pilot project is going to start playing out at Alverno yet?
I don't. The pilot project is in two phases. We're in the first phase, which is convening the partners to figure out exactly how to name the EEQs. We've got draft names of them, and some of us have feelings about the language, as you'd imagine a bunch of higher ed people would.
Especially ones who might be English majors.
Right, right. And there are other universities that have a competency-based model, and so we all feel very strongly that we are really good at this, and so we want to help shape it. So we're spending this year refining both the qualities themselves and developing a process by which programs become validated or I forget what the word they actually use is, but certified as an EEQ program. Once we've created that framework, then year two, which starts next fall, is having programs go through that framework to see if the framework actually works before we try and roll it out further. One of the things we've learned at Alverno is that the draft EEQs and our eight abilities are a real nice alignment. You can draw clear connecting lines among them. So I think the ways that it'll play out at Alverno is that we'll be able to continue doing what we already do. We'll have another platform for making it public, and we'll have another thing that a graduate can walk out in the world and say, hey, I've got this thing too that will make me a better candidate for the work I'm looking for.
Well, and it sounds like we have more interviews to do as this
that would be great.
Starts to coalesce.
Yeah.
Well, Carol Shabrias, thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thanks so much.
Carol Shabrias is Dean of the School of Adult Learning and New Initiatives at Alverno College. Alverno is one of two schools in Wisconsin and 14 around the country to help develop ways to assess students' essential employable qualities. You can read more at WUWM.com.
If you are considering seeing a movie this weekend, contributor Dave Lurson shares his thoughts about one film getting plenty of critical attention, most of it good. He'll talk about Lady Bird when Lake Effect continues in just a moment on WUWM.
It's Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. From Rebel Without a Cause to The Breakfast Club to 10 Things I Hate About You, coming-of-age movies have been around for almost as long as the film industry.
Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig's directorial debut, is the latest offering in the genre. The film tells the semi-autobiographical story of Christine Lady Bird McPherson, played by Saoirse Ronan, in her final year of high school in Sacramento, California. Set in the early 2000s, Lady Bird shows how America was changing post-9/11 and how Lady Bird's perspective on her her hometown, her family, and her life was changing along with it.
I want to go where culture is,
but
like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or
a
at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire,
well,
where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You can't even pass your driver's test.
Because you wouldn't let me practice
the way
enough.
That you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird like
Christine.
You said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
The film also broke a record this week on Rotten Tomatoes, emerging as the critics' new movie darling, beating Toy Story 2 as the movie with 164 fresh reviews and counting and zero rotten reviews against it.
Film critic Dave Lurson is one of the many critics who has positive words for Lady Bird, and he joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss the film. And he says it was a great step forward for writer and director Greta Gerwig.
I think that Lady Bird is a great step forward for her. This movie works very well as a compelling, genuine statement, I think, of herself. But I think it has universal meaning. I found myself relating to a number of things in the life of the protagonist, the self-proclaimed Lady Bird, as she tries, as the high school senior protagonist of the film, a girl in a Sacramento high school, a person with creative aspirations who feels that Sacramento is a dead end, the Midwest of California,
yes.
She memorably calls it at one point. And she dreams of going to New York and doesn't quite know how to do all these things. I mean, I related to her character a lot. She reminded me in certain ways of myself during middle school and high school, where you're trying to invent an identity for yourself in some way. You want to be somewhere else. You're trying to figure out how to get there. There isn't really a roadmap, you know, laid out for you. You have to kind of figure it out on the fly. There's also, you know, money problems. It's not as if you can just, you know, pay your way, or your parents can pay your way to go to Yale or Harvard or some expensive university on the East Coast. Are you going to be stuck with, you know, in her case, Sacramento Technical College or whatever the equivalent would be out there? So she's faced with a great many things, including finding herself, you know, in terms of her emotions, in terms of her sexual exploration. So a lot of things are going on, I mean, for a teenager of that year. I think the movie encapsulates that time of life very well.
Definitely. And Saoirse Ronan, who audiences know from her Oscar-nominated role in Brooklyn, I'm very happy with her performance because too often older people play high schoolers, and it just doesn't feel authentic. But
she's,
I mean,
23,
she's 23, so she's closer in age than the typical actor playing a high school student. But her delivery and her pacing just adds a certain spark and fire to this character. While it's also, you know, it's a lot of juxtapositions with her. You know, she wants to be independent and individual, yet she conforms in certain ways, or wants to rush into becoming a woman in various aspects, whether that's academically, personally, sexually, and yet still has a childish-like outlook on a lot of things.
Ooh, very realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, at no point while watching her did I think this actress is too old for the role she is playing. I had to kind of, you know, check back afterward to see how old she was. Oh, 23. And I remember her from a variety of movies, Grand Hotel Budapest. She's in that one, too. She's actually had a 10-year career in film already. She must have begun at age 13. And maybe she remembers very clearly what it was like to be a teenager. It's not that far away from her.
While the characters are familiar and it's, you know, a story about Lady Bird and her family and the life of a teenager as they're on that precipice of senior year into college, it's not portrayed as a cliche or dull story or characters with all this. You know, there's a new, fresh take on it, which I thought is a great accomplishment for something that's explored so much.
Well, it's a Catholic high school, and even the nuns are not cliche high school teacher nuns that you see over and over again in comedies. All of the characters had a kind of ring of authenticity to them, like whether they were comical people or a little bit, where they were, you know, tragic or some mixture of this. Everyone to me seemed like a real person. The mother character in this movie is kind of interesting because the opening scenes where they're having an argument, the daughter and the mother, in a car on the way back from some, you know, campus tour, naturally some dreary college not too far away from where they live, which is where her mother wants her to go because there isn't any money. And unless you get some great scholarship from somewhere, and you're kind of a mediocre student academically in some ways anyway, so don't dream on about that. They're having this argument, and one would peg the mother then as being a typical sort of grouchy, you know, guilt trip laying on kind of a person who you're not going to like. But as the movie goes on, you find a much broader person, really in many ways a very generous person, evidently. And if there's a structural weakness in the film, it's at least, I don't think it was explained very well. She adopted two biologically unrelated teenagers from difficult home environments. And so, you know, it's an unconventional family in that kind of sense. She's working very hard. The mother is two shifts at the hospital. She has a lot of burdens, and one can really understand the pressures that she is under just as well as one can understand the protagonist, Lady Bird, in this film.
Right, and this movie really touches upon the notes of, okay, we've all rebelled and think we've known what's best for us, but in the end we realize how great our parents are in some cases. And the relationship between the mother and daughter in this movie, probably a lot of people can identify with. You know, there's a lot of aspects someone can personally connect to.
Right. And the father character also, I mean, it's a two-parent, if unconventional, family in some ways. The father is afflicted by the very common problem of fearing job loss, and indeed he is laid off after a while. His company is going through downsizing. The economic precariousness of the lower middle class is something I don't think is being discussed enough, certainly not in Hollywood movies. And one of my, you know, annoyed reactions to a lot of indie films, they all take place in Manhattan on the tree-lined side streets, and everybody seems to have a trust fund. You know, there are, fine, if that's your reality as a filmmaker, we'll go for it then. But, I mean, there's a lot of other kinds of people in America and in the world who should be represented on film. I think that this movie does a great job of showing how not the 1% or the 10%, but maybe how, you know, 50 or 60% of the people in this country actually live.
Yeah, I thought this movie did a great job of kind of giving a little nudge and reminder of all the things that happened. It's set in 2002, 2003 school year, but as you mentioned, it deals with the lower middle class, the fear of being laid off during a recession. It deals with depression, such as the father's character, and her mother works at a psychiatric hospital. So it doesn't shy away from things like that, or coming out, or how friendships change, or exploratory things in your life. It deals with it with a realistic honesty that doesn't shy away from it, but it doesn't stigmatize or shame any aspect of it.
It doesn't stigmatize or shame, and the drama in the movie at times is played with a light enough touch. You don't leave the film feeling depressed, you know, for anybody, really. I mean, it's a very deft touch where you can move people and make an audience aware of the difficulties that realistic characters are having and still leave the theater feeling bright in some way. And I think that Greta Gerwig, the writer-director, accomplished that. I'm looking forward to what she does in the future based on this.
And some of the details I really loved because it was set in this time frame, everything from the music choices to the little shell necklaces that some of the characters had. Like, it just took me back there instantly. Like, that attention to detail.
Yeah, and fewer handheld devices, I think, was the thing that I noticed.
Yeah.
People were forced more, I think, to talk to each other. You didn't have the phenomenon of people sitting side by side texting each other or whatever. You had to communicate. I wonder if in the future, you know, if society continues to go down this direction, what kind of films we will have based upon people texting each other as a primary means of communication. You know, lettering fill the screen, every frame. I think that would be kind of a boring way of making movies. So I was very happy that we had, you know, a good ensemble cast, really, that again, all of the actors in this film seem to really bring their characters alive with a deep kind of understanding for who they were.
Yeah, it is definitely one of the more accomplished female-led coming-of-age tales compared to the multitude of John Hughes movies in the golden age of coming-out teenage stories. But although it can be classified as a teenage comedy, I'd say it's, you know, more of a dramedy, or, you know, what do you call just a great, honest depiction of something? You know, I think
realism.
It's realism.
Well, realism, because, you know, real life for you know, if in most cases for most people involves humor, right? We hope anyway, involves tragedy, involves disappointment. It involves obstacles that sometimes we overcome and sometimes we don't overcome. So I think that this is realism. I really hate the word dramedy. I mean, it's make-believe kind of words. It's like rom-con for yeah. You know, romantic comedy. Mediocre movie critics coined these things, and I'd rather not use them. But a mixture of drama and comedy, a slice of real life. I mean, I think that's what you have in Lady Bird.
It's gotten 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, which was
pretty
probably
good.
One of the few.
Yeah.
Has great reviews from us and other film critics. And what words of advice would you have for anyone who's on the fence of seeing this? Because although it is an indie film, I think it could easily hold its own if it was out of the Oriental and in a Marcus cinema.
Well, I hope it expands beyond the Landmarks theater chain and equivalent chains around the country. I think it's a movie that really should deserve some Oscar consideration when the time comes. It's not that far away right now, maybe especially in light with the disruption going on in Hollywood. I mean, much needed, I suppose, too, with many of the old dogs of the industry being driven out because of their legacy of misconduct going back decades. I'm wondering how this is going to affect the Motion Picture Academy and the various committees that are involved in the nomination process, that maybe this will open some eyes to more movies made by women about the particular situations of women. So this could be not only on the strength of it being a very good movie, but in the context of everything else going on right now, this could be an opening for Lady Bird.
I look forward to seeing what happens. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Larson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express, author of its I Hate Hollywood blog, and a regular Lake Effect contributor. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski about the film Lady Bird. Friend, I want the when, where, and how. Old friends do tend to become old habits. We'll take another short break and then return with the next episode in our Radio Chipstone series. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. New ones are quickly made. Some of them were something too. But us, all the friends. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday. Those who celebrate Christmas and or the other holidays are spending large sums of money trying to find the perfect gift. Parents are wrestling with the question of which toy, video, game, song, whatever they're willing to listen to, play, or step on for the foreseeable future.
Well, in this edition of Radio Chipstone, contributor Jennifer Fields chats with her friend and colleague Matt McHugh about something he once cherished.
So here we have the Red Ranger from Power Rangers riding on this awesome dirt bike.
And it is awesome, Matt. So what's the story behind this toy? When did you get this?
You know, I don't remember exactly when I got it. It was probably, my guess, around 8 or 9 years old. That's when I was, like, super into Power Rangers. I really like to imagine a lot. You know, I'd, like, wander around the backyard, like, holding this stick, just imagining I was a superhero. And it's kind of, you know, having superpowers and all that, so.
Did you ask for this toy, or did your parents know you well enough to know that you wanted this toy?
My sense is they probably knew me well enough that I wanted, you know, pretty much anything Power Rangers I was all about. They were the bee's knees to me, like my favorite. So.
Can you remember what that first sort of experience was like? And looking at this toy, you know, I can imagine a young Matt being really, really, really excited about
it. Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And looking at it now, you're still kind of playing with it, but it's not... I'm wondering, where's the nostalgia? Is it transformative when you hold this toy? Does it take you back to that time period?
It does a little bit. I know when, because, you know, my folks recently dropped off a bunch of my old toys at my place. It was cluttering up their house. So I know when I first dug into that, you know, and picked this up, I did feel for a moment that sort of letting everything go and just being completely in the moment with this toy and transported to that imagination world. So I kind of remembered a little bit of that feeling. I'm sure I wanted to dig it out and immediately start playing with it and imagining when I first got it.
But the problem, Matt, is that you left it there in the first place. You had access to it. When you left that house, you didn't take this with you.
That's true. You know, I was trying to think when it was sort of put away, and I imagine probably late middle school or early high school. You know, it either got put in the closet or in the basement, I imagine. I don't really remember playing with it during that time. So at some point, you know, get distracted with whatever else you need to do.
So now that you have this toy, are you going to keep this thing?
This one I am. I have a special place in my heart for anything Power Rangers. And so anything like this I'm going to hang on to for a while.
Okay. There's a difference between hanging on to something and interacting with it and touching it and using it. Is this going to be on the shelf collecting dust, or are you going to bust it out every once in a while and revisit that sort of nostalgic moment of being a child?
I imagine that'll probably happen by accident. You know, it's down in our storage unit of our apartment right now, so I probably won't set out to do that, but as I'm moving stuff around down there, I'll probably come across the old crate and open it up and take a look, but probably not intentionally.
I'm wondering why your parents kept it. Why did they keep your toys? If it was collecting space, it would be easier to donate it than it would be. How far away are they from you?
They live about an hour and 10 minutes away in a small town. I mean, they've been bugging me for years to come pick up my old stuff. So eventually, I think they're like, we're bringing all your old stuff to you. Here you go. It's out of our hands. So it was partially on me.
As you play with this toy and as you look at this toy and I ask you these ridiculous questions, is more of this coming back to you? Or do you think that that part of you is locked away? And like peeking through a keyhole, there's only little glimpses of it that we'll see.
I think the keyhole analogy is a good one. I find it pretty difficult to sort of have that, you know, childlike creativity or sort of loss of responsibility or thinking about all these other things that you should do or have to do or whatnot and just really feel like yourself. Because that's one thing I noticed when I first dug out this toy is like I felt like myself for a moment, just totally free and just alive. And I think that's hard to connect with these days.
Is it because you feel that you're shirking responsibilities, or because it's, to go back to that place, reminds you what you lose when you grow up?
Reminding you of what you lose when you grow up.
It just seems like even just physically, there's this muscle memory with you and playing with this toy and making sure that it looks like the cool Power Ranger on his motorcycle and not just some plastic thing hanging off with one leg.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the Power Rangers were like my idols, and I really felt like I was one of them when I was playing with these toys. So, yeah, that's important that, you know, they look good and maintain their qualities and whatnot. Yeah.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
We'll take one last break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on WUWM.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time for Ex Fabula Radio, once again part of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Winter, and joining us once again this week, world-famous Desiree Constantino, sitting in for Leah Delaney, who will be home from her globetrotting ways next week. So welcome once again. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Bruce. I think Leah's the one that's world famous now, but I'll take it.
All right. We have a couple of stories today based on the theme, this year being the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches in Milwaukee.
Yeah, we do. Next Tuesday, December 5th, we have our first Secret Fabula of the year, and it's the housing marches through the UWM archives. If you're not familiar with the Secret Fabulas, they're a special event, special storytelling event that is usually for members through Ex Fabula. So if you're not a member, you should do that now, because then you get into this event for free. And what we do is we go to different locations throughout the city, and we have, say, the proprietors or the people that work at this at these places tell stories about the history of the sites. And then we have other people, you know, people that have been there tell stories as well. So with it being, you know, the 200 days towards freedom and the 50th anniversary of the housing marches, we'll be exploring the UWM archives of the housing marches, which are pretty powerful. And so this weekend we have two stories that touch on those themes of housing and overt and maybe, you know, subversive racism, and then a beautiful story about friends and neighborhoods.
All right, let's do the first one then. Who's up?
The first one is actually an encore. We played this earlier this year, but it really fits in with what we're talking about today. And it's Sue Blaustein from our Only in Milwaukee Story Slam from last April.
I moved to Milwaukee in 1979. I'd grown up in New York. I lived in Madison for 5 years, and I made it here. And tonight, I just went to an event before I came here. It was an open house from a organization that I have a really long history with, the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. We are going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Federal Fair Housing Act. And my time in Milwaukee, a few years into my time in Milwaukee, I got to intersect with this interesting slice, because Milwaukee has a very rich history in the area of fair housing. I had a really nice upper flat at 41st Street, just north of Hampton Avenue. It was an upper flat above the owners of the house. They were an elderly couple. I was a lot younger then. And it was a great place, great price, close to my work. I worked at W.H. Brady then. And the only thing was, the landlord was really nosy. I don't know if that was just a Milwaukee phenomenon, but he was really nosy, very paternal, which I guess was nice. I would come and go. I worked second shift a lot of the time. But somehow he always managed to be at the back door when I was coming or going. Oh, Susan, what are you doing? Oh, you worked overtime on Saturday. Yeah, I thought we saw you leave early. And I'm like, oh my God. I was feeling a little smothered, but anyhow, nice apartment, good location. I kind of put up with it. Actually, I didn't live there right away, but anyhow, 1983, I started dating a black man, and he would come visit me, and I introduced them to him, you know, because they're always at the back door when I'm going up. You know, and I have decent manners. Hi, you know, this is Maurice. He's a friend of mine. Oh, okay. Anyhow, on Mother's Day, this is great, on Mother's Day, he had spent the night before, and when he left in the morning, and then not long after that, my landlord said, Susan, can we talk to you? And I go downstairs, His wife had always been kind of on the quiet side. She says to me, "Are you running a cat house up there?" I was like, "Whoa." And he said to me, "You know, we can't have this, Susan. We have lots of nice things in this house." And I was like, "Okay." Now, I wasn't very strategic about working the law, so I jumped the gun and said, "Fine, I'm out of here." And I found another apartment, but I also had a lot of activist friends. I was an activist, and I knew about the Fair Housing Council. And I went to them and I told them what happened. And they said, "Yeah, you have some recourse, even though it's an owner-occupied building. And there's a lot of details involved. I had to write up a narrative of what happened." They said, "Well, you sure to go back and discuss it with him, because it's better if he actually evicts you. You kind of jumped the gun by, like, I'm out of here." But anyhow, to make a long story short, they did help me recover. This is, what, 1983. They helped me recover some money from my moving expenses. And I became a volunteer investigator for them as a result of this. And that's a really wonderful way to learn that discrimination and racism doesn't always have that ugly, hateful face where they're just going to say, "No, we don't rent to you people." But the things that I was told when I went to seek a unit, and the things that people of color were told when they presented similar income and other characteristics, the things that they were told about availability, it's like, okay, this has been laid bare, what goes on. And maybe not only in Milwaukee, but definitely a feature of life here. And at 40 years, they still shouldn't be having to pursue these things, but they're alive and kicking.
And that was Sue Blaustein sharing her Only Milwaukee story from last April.
And that kind of very implied, covert kind of racism from not necessarily a landlord, but homeowner, is something that was so pervasive, probably not only in Milwaukee, but you could really notice it when you came face to face with it back in the day.
Oh, exactly. And I think what's also really cool about the story is how Sue got involved with the Fair Housing Initiative and continues to till this day. And, you know, with Milwaukee being one of the most segregated city in the country, we can see that it's still necessary for people like this to be active.
Exactly. This second story that we have today, I listened to it ahead of time, and this is a great one. It is two friends from different neighborhoods. Beautiful story.
Yeah, Elaine Molly and LG Shanklin Flowers, they told a duo story at our Creating a Welcoming Community in Bayview. We did that last May, and basically they did a Rashomon, or a duo story, and they shared their viewpoints on each other's neighborhoods, which are one is on the north side and one is very south side, and both their fears and what they like about each other's neighborhoods and the differences. And it's pretty powerful.
I grew up on the far northwest side. I moved to Bayview as a young single parent over 35 years ago. The rent was cheap. My kids could play in the park. I could walk to the grocery store. Downtown was just a little hop away, and I could get to any other place I wanted to go in about 20 minutes. I'd be lying if I didn't admit that the fact that it was mostly white gave me a sense of safety.
I've lived in the 53208 zip code area for about 30 years, and in Cold Springs Park, which is from 27th to 35th and Valete to Highland since 1997. We moved there because we wanted to live in a neighborhood where people were connected. Our daughter could run from home to home, and we knew that the neighbors would be looking out for her. I love the big, old, affordable houses in my neighborhood. And it was also important for me to live in a diverse neighborhood because I didn't want my daughter to grow up being afraid of black people.
Even though I'm an empty nester now, I want to stay in Bayview. I love my house on the corner of Pine and Morgan. I've owned it for over almost 20 years now. And we benefit by an active neighborhood association. I'm a regular at Chill on the Hill and the Farmer's Market. Kids come from all over the place to trick or treat. The neighbors shovel my sidewalks in the winter when I'm gone.
Our home is on 31st and McKinley, and we've been there for quite a while. I love my neighborhood, and I love that people are friendly, and I can come and go and feel comfortable where I am, as well as welcoming my family and friends to my neighborhood.
What I don't like about my neighborhood is the noise. I live on a four-corner stop, and sometimes the traffic is heavy. And cars drive by with the windows open and the music blasting. Sometimes the airplane noise is so loud I can't talk on the phone. Oh, and then there's the trains.
My neighborhood is mostly quiet, at least by 11 o'clock at night. Cars coming by, lots of music. And even though we have speed boats and bumps, cars tend to try to skip over those. Outside of that, that's pretty much my neighborhood. The 53208 zip code area has 32,000 residents, and there's not one major grocery store in my zip code.
I mostly feel safe in Bayview, but I'm cautious. I keep the doors locked. I take my cell phone with me when I go for a walk. A few years ago, a drunk driver crashed into the tree in front of my kitchen window. Another time, I heard a gunshot and found a bullet hole in my living room window. My son's car was stolen. Just the other day, there was headline news about a sexual predator living in Bayview. Yet no one ever asks me why I continue to live here.
I definitely feel safe, though I have to admit, I do lock the door, and I'm cautious. I pay attention to what's going on around me. Occasionally, I'll hear gunshots in the distance, and it's usually around the holidays, 4th of July or New Year's Eve. Mostly, I know that if something was happening, I could run out of my house and run in many directions and find people who would be willing to assist me if I was in trouble or needed help.
When I visit LG in her neighborhood, I'm cautious. I have to fight the noise in my head that says that her neighborhood isn't as safe as mine. I don't want to get lost there. I don't want to be there late at night. And if I saw a large group of black teenagers, I might go the other way. But you know, because I know that people like LG live in that neighborhood, I'm fairly certain if I got into trouble, someone would help me.
When I come to Bayview, I notice the nice, tidy houses and all kinds of activity going on, and I love Elaine and Tom's house. But I have to be honest, I'm of a generation that the idea of driving south still causes me to get queasy. And as I move down 27th Street south, I notice the neighborhood's changing, and less do I feel like it's a place where I'm supposed to be. When I see signs like I support the badge and Blue Lives Matter, I don't feel safe. When I see a Black Lives Matter sign in Bayview, if I were in trouble, I would feel like I could go there and that person would help me.
And that was Elaine and LG Shanklin Flowers, Elaine Raleigh. And that's how they each see each other's neighborhoods.
And how it has changed over the years, too, I'm sure.
Very much so. And then, again, how some things still stay the same.
Now, the Secret Fabula event is coming up real quick next week.
Secret Fabula is coming up next Tuesday, December 5th. It's from 6 to 8 at the UWM Golda Meir Library in the archives. And tickets are available to non-members. But if you are an ex-Fabula member, you get in for free. So now would be a great time to purchase that membership or give it as a gift because it is the holiday season.
And all information on all events and other accessories regarding ex-Fabula is at your website, exfabula.org. And if you want to listen again to these stories or share them with somebody, we have them posted at WUWM.com. Desiree, it has been a pleasure these last 3 weeks.
Thank you, Bruce. I've enjoyed it as well.
Ex Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Keep listening because Weekend All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock.